The title is a bit of spy jargon, and blowback is unforeseen negative consequences at home of covert operations overseas. And in his book, Christopher Simpson makes the argument that there were a variety of forms of blowback that were a result of our recruitment of Nazis, using them in various ways. He says that basically, he says that it helped erode trust and poison the relationship between the superpowers. It helped to fuel and escalate the Cold War, that it had a effect on American domestic politics as well. And he documents all of those things in his book. And we will be talking about that here in this part of Focus as we talk with him. Of course, you folks who are listening are invited to call in as well. Perhaps at some point you will have some questions or thoughts to offer. And you're welcome to do that. Our telephone number here is 333-9455. That is our Champaign-Urbana number. We also have a line for those of you elsewhere out there in Illinois. If it will be a long-distance call for you, use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Simpson, hello.
Hello, David.
Glad that you could be with us.
Yes, it's a pleasure.
It is a fascinating book, really, really quite fascinating, and I'm sure that it would be a disturbing revelation to a lot of people, as it's a bit of history that I think has not been very, very well documented, if at all. Perhaps to start out, we'll talk about how things started with the recruitment of former Nazis, and I gather that the first people really to be recruited were scientists, were technological types. After the defeat of Germany, I think both the United States and the Soviet Union looked at it and saw great scientific wealth, both in terms of technology and information and hardware, but also of people. And so some of the first people that we were interested in were scientists. How did they go about deciding who they would admit, and how did they justify recruiting these people?
Okay, well, the story of the scientists is reasonably well known in sort of popular mythology in this country. Bob Hope had a joke during the 1950s in which the reason that the Soviets were able to launch Sputnik before the American space program made it into space was because supposedly their German scientists were better than our German scientists. But underneath the jokes, there's an undercurrent which is not so pleasant. Basically, what happened with the scientific community in Germany is, in order for them to succeed during the Nazi period, in order for them to advance in their profession and get the funding that they wanted for their projects and so forth, it was necessary to cooperate with the Nazi German government for a period of 15 years. And some academics were able to do this successfully without too seriously compromising their integrity, and others joined the Nazi movement wholesale. In any case, at the end of the war, there was a screening process set up over here in the United States to look at these scientists and try to determine whether or not they had simply been opportunistically, that was the term used at the time, opportunistically cooperating with the Nazis, or whether they should actually be considered, a given individual should actually be considered a war criminal. And the problem that the board faced is that they kept getting the investigative reports from Germany that said that these people, or that many of them, had been enthusiastic Nazis, that they'd been active supporters of Nazi Germany. So the Pentagon, which was one of the main sponsors of that particular program, sent a message back to Germany that said, please don't send us any more of these compromising dossiers. There's no point in even presenting them to the committee. So what happened was a new group of dossiers came back that were sanitized, in which the compromising information was cut out And then the scientists came through the screening committee and arrived in the United States.
So the people hadn't changed. They were the same people. It's just that those back here in the United States said there were some things about these people we would prefer not to know, so don't tell us.
That's right. The files had changed, not mm-hmm. the people.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps we also, as a way of sort of laying groundwork for what we're talking about, I guess when you talk about how people here in the United States and levels in many levels of government were able to justify recruitment of these people, I suppose we ought to say for the record that very early on, apparently even before the Second World War was over, there were a lot of people in intelligence and in the military who immediately turned their attention to the Soviet Union and began, as I say, even before the Second World War was over, to anticipate the next war, which
yes,
they felt
right.
would be with the Soviets. And apparently in all of these cases, it was a situation where the justification was, we've got to get ready for this next war. It's inevitable. And if we can use these people, we might as well.
Well, that's right. That's right. And the main topic of the book is not so much the scientists, although there is discussion of the scientists, but rather the German spy networks and the German psychological warfare operatives and strong-arm specialists who were recruited for covert warfare activities. What one sees if you look at the history of the development, particularly of the CIA, but more broadly speaking of the intelligence complex in the United States, so what some people call the national security state, if you look at where that came from, what you see is it evolved in the wake of World War II, where there was great emphasis placed on covert operations of different types, as a foreign policy strategy of the United States. And at the time, covert operations were sort of a complement to the atomic bomb. In other words, both of these innovations were perceived as offering more bang for the buck to the policymakers in Washington than having soldiers all over the world. But then if you start to look at the covert operations themselves, what you discover is, particularly during the Cold War years, the early Cold War years, that the use of persons recruited from Nazi Germany and from Germany's intelligence service were really at the core of these covert operations during that time period.
Mm-hmm. You go on to talk about this German officer, Reinhard Gehlen.
Sure.
He is an interesting case in point. Apparently, this man was Hitler's most senior military intelligence officer in the East.
Yes, that's
and
right.
That even before the fighting was over in 1944, he, like other German officers, started to contemplate surrender. And he had access to a huge volume of information that the Germans had collected, gathered largely from Soviet POWs, on Russian military strength and military planning and so forth. He microfilmed all of this stuff, buried it in various places in the Alps in Austria, and surrendered to the Allies, and then soon afterwards said, by the way, I have this information for you, and I think that we can make some sort of a deal. And the United States apparently decided that he could be very valuable in setting up an espionage network to allow them to get information behind the Iron Curtain that otherwise they couldn't have any access to.
Well, that they felt that they couldn't have any access to.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the story you tell is exactly right. Gehlen was a very important character, and he eventually emerged as chief of West Germany's intelligence service. The thing that there's an important aspect to understanding the Gehlen situation, and that is how the Soviets perceived it in 1945. Now, obviously, everything the Americans do does not have to be approved in advance by the Soviets. However, given the circumstances in 1945, the two countries were allied at that point. It appeared to many people, including people at senior levels of the government, that it might be possible to have more or less normal relations, diplomatic relations, between the United States and the Soviet Union after World War II. Well, when we recruited Galen, this sent a message to the Soviets. The recruitment of Galen was supposedly secret, but the fact of the matter is they knew what was going on. The message that they perceived was that the U.S. was hiring these Nazi spies and intelligence agents to use in a continuing conflict against the Soviets. Now, this is a country that's just gone through this devastating war. They've lost something like 20 million people, enormous cost in both human life and, you know, industrial property and so forth. And here, in their eyes, are the perfidious capitalists hiring one of their most dangerous enemies and secretly putting him back to work. So the question, what this points up is that when you hire somebody like Galen, it's not simply a matter of getting his information and then we'll send our specialists in and look at it and we'll make a decision. It has implications and it has effects which can be much greater than seem at first glance.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you also, you make this statement in the book, of all of the networks of former Nazis and collaborators employed by the U.S. after World War II, it is this man, Galen's organization, that left the most substantial imprint on the United States. In what way, or what effect did that have on the U.S.?
Well, there's several different ways. One, the most prominent has to do with American foreign affairs, but there's also certain effects on American domestic affairs that we can go into later, if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at the foreign situation first. As the Cold War became more and more frigid, the stakes got higher and the situation became more dangerous. Galen systematically overestimated the Russian troop strength in Europe and the dangerousness of what the Soviets were up to. Let me give you a specific example. When the U.S. looked at what the Soviets were doing, one of the main barometers that we used to try to figure out what their intentions were was the size of the Red Army. Were they taking the Red Army home, or were they leaving it in place? Was the Red Army preparing for an attack on West Germany? What was the Red Army doing? So this was looked at as one of the most important indicators of what the Soviets were up to. Well, looking back today, what we know is that, number one, we relied on Galen, almost exclusively on Galen, to provide us information about the Red Army. It's because his organization had been involved in a fight with the Red Army during World War II, so the theory was that he was our best source of information on it. And number two, we know that he systematically exaggerated both the size of the Red Army and its degree of war readiness. In other words, he would take occupation troops that were tied down with basically police duties in the Soviet-occupied territories and describe them as assault troops who were about to launch an attack on West Germany. Well, you know, this was very alarming to the Americans for obvious reasons. And what would happen is that the CIA and military intelligence would leak this information into the press, and the press would have a big storm. Oh, my goodness, the Soviets are about to attack. And then, surprise, surprise, well, this would happen right in the middle of the budget appropriation process for the Pentagon. Well, the budget appropriation would go through at a higher level. Galen would get a piece of the pie. Galen's operation would remain a going concern. And what has since come to be called the military-industrial complex was satisfied as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this. You know, there's a certain wheel that turns, or a certain social dynamic in which particularly the military side of society will exaggerate the degree of danger that the country is in order to prepare, in order to expand its influence. And Galen ended up playing a very important role in that whole process. He gave them the information that they needed to do the job.
Yeah. We're talking this morning on Focus in this hour with Christopher Simpson, author of Blowback. As it says on the cover, the first full account of America's recruitment of Nazis and its disastrous effect on our domestic and foreign policy. We are also open to comments, and I have a caller who's been waiting quite a bit and want to include them. Other folks are welcome as well. If you have questions or would like to speak with our guest, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We will go here to this caller. Pardon me for keeping you hanging on so long. Go ahead.
That's quite all right. Just two items I'd like to mention. One was a friend of ours who
Pardon me, ma'am, you're really faint. It's kind of hard to hear you. Yeah.
Oh, is that better?
Yes, that's better. Thanks.
Uh-huh. A friend of ours who was in the service met with face-to-face with Russian soldiers there in the Second Front in World War II, and he said that this was very difficult to communicate with them because the Russian soldiers did not know who if the Americans were their enemies or their friends. They had to get out of their way when they saw them coming. And another item that really happened near where I live here in northern Illinois, this is a place called Sycamore. I don't live in Sycamore, but this is where this occurred. I believe the name of the town was Sycamore. There they had German prisoners of war that they brought over, and they were out there in Sycamore, and they worked, I guess, the fields out there. And then the people said that they were very peaceful acting, and they sang as they went to their work.
Hmm. Is that something you can comment on?
Well, I don't have a particular comment on that.
I'm not quite sure what the thrust of your point is, ma'am.
It really is no thrust to it. It's just an item which is rather interesting, I think, that people don't know really what is going on in a war unless you're there. We didn't, I know, here. And then when these German POWs were brought out here to the Middle West, they were kept on this farm out in Sycamore, and they worked there. Mm-hmm. And it was rather interesting that they sang as they went to their work each day. I thought it was kind of an interesting sideline.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I thank you for the call. Let me invite other people also to call if you have questions for our guest or you want to be a part of the discussion. Our telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. Another way in which intelligence people and people in the CIA here anticipated and I guess actually did use former Nazis and collaborators was as covert underground armies, I suppose, doing our bidding or fulfilling our agenda in places like in Greece and in Italy. And in fact, there, as we thought about the possibility of fighting nuclear war, these sort of clandestine armies became a very important part of our strategy and were thought of as, I don't know what one might say, surrogates, I suppose, that would be there and waiting in the event of a nuclear war so that they could seize power and essentially fight for our interests.
Right, right. Well, the idea was this, is that during the war, Hitler Germany had occupied large parts of the Soviet Union and had set up Quisling governments made up of local collaborators in the occupation zone. And these people, the collaborators, tended to be fairly well organized. They included people who had experience as city administrators, as propagandists, as police chiefs, and so forth. And I think it's important to note that these collaborationist administrations were absolutely instrumental in the Nazis' Holocaust. And the reason is simply because, being the local people, they knew where the local Jews were. They knew where the local communists were. So that when Germany set out to massacre the Jews of Russia, well, they hired local people to show them the way to the settlements. Well, anyway, at the end of the war, these collaborators tended to flee back to Nazi Germany, and the American covert services, and also the French and the British and even the Soviets, looked at these organizations in Germany and felt that they could hire them for different types of psychological warfare operations. And one thing that's interesting about it is that the degree to which these covert agents were penetrated by the other side. In other words, the ones on the American payroll were penetrated by Soviet double agents, the ones on the French payroll were penetrated by British and American agents, and so forth around the circle.
Mm-hmm. I think you have a remarkable story in the book about how in 1950, I believe it was, that in Germany, the CIA and Army intelligence used a cover group to train 100 members of a far-right wing German organization, and it was called the League of Young Germans.
Sure.
Although mostly, I gather, they were Army veterans. They weren't, as you say in the book, they weren't Boy Scouts. And that this group decided on their own that the best thing that they could do for Germany in the event of a Soviet attack was to assassinate German leaders that they thought insufficiently anti-communist, and they actually drew up a hit list of these people, and that this whole thing sort of unraveled when a chance arrest led the German police to discover this list. And of course, apparently the CIA said that they didn't know anything about it. It seems remarkable that, as you say in the book, that one could hide an armed force of, quote, several thousand enthusiastic anti-communists in the European heartland, but somehow we did for some period of time manage to do that.
Right, right. Well, the assassination squads are particularly interesting. You know, it's because during the 1970s it became clear that the intelligence service of the United States had for some time the capability to assassinate foreign leaders that it disagreed with. And these operations involved people in Chile. There was an attempt to assassinate Chinese Prime Minister Chiang Kai-shek. There were actual assassinations of Lumumba in Congo, and so forth and so on. These and many attempted assassinations of Fidel Castro. The roots of these murder programs can be traced back to the recruitment of these Nazi agents in the wake of World War II. And I think this is one example of how we have gotten into our present fix as far as international affairs are concerned. You look at the Nicaragua situation. You look at the General Noriega situation. The same types of tactics that the U.S. is pursuing in those countries are the same tactics that were tested in the Cold War, in the early Cold War years. Now, if we look back at those years, we can see that they did not work particularly well when they were tried then, and yet here we are using them again.
Mm-hmm. We're talking in Focus today with Christopher Simpson. He's an investigative reporter based in Washington. He's the author of the book Blowback. It's an account of the recruitment of Nazis and Nazi collaborators by American intelligence services after the Second World War. Something else that you write about in the book is the activities of primarily the CIA in the United States, propaganda efforts to build up and establish the legitimacy of these surrogate armies that we were building for us around the world. Just what exactly did the CIA do to try to polish the image of these exile groups that we were supporting?
Well, I think many of your listeners will remember Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which were American-sponsored radio programs broadcasting into the East Bloc countries. Now, we know today that those organizations were funded by the CIA. That's who paid their bills, paid the professors, and so forth. Well, those organizations also served as conduits or pass-through points for money going to certain émigré organizations that had some of the émigré organizations were just basic anti-communist émigré organizations, democratic organizations, perfectly decent people. Some of them, however, had been Nazi collaborators during the war and were led by Nazi collaborators. And you can go back and look at the congresses of these organizations and establish exactly who was in charge. Anyway, here in the U.S., there was a propaganda campaign, a publicity effort, called the Crusade for Freedom. And what the official purpose of the Crusade for Freedom was to raise money for Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty. So there would be free advertisements on television, there would be advertisements in the newspapers and magazines, there would be meetings that received heavy publicity in the newspapers and so forth. And the theme of these ads was supposedly that the people who are paying for Radio Free Europe are concerned Americans who are sending in nickels and dimes to support the program. Well, the fact of the matter was, it was the nickel and dime collections added up to less than 5% of those projects' budget. The other 95% came from the CIA. And the real purpose of the Crusade for Freedom, according to the project's own documents, was to publicize to America the Cold War version of what was going on in Eastern Europe, to promote that analysis of world affairs to an American audience. And one thing that's interesting about it is that many people would agree that it was completely illegal. The CIA had no business engaging in broadcast to the American people. That's simply not the agency's job.
Mm-hmm. Over time, a lot of people that were recruited, both Nazis and former collaborators, were, for one way or another, were brought to the United States. People were brought here to train our people. They were brought here for their own expertise. In fact, I gather that after that debacle with the young Germans that we referred to before, the people who had the assassination list of German government officials, someone even had the idea that to bring some of these people that we had been training and equipping to the United States and enlist them in the American Army.
Yeah.
So a lot of people came here to the United States, did and attempted to, according to their own interest, influence American politics as well. Was there an influence on American politics by these people?
Yes. I would say that there was a subtle influence on U.S. politics, but a real one. If, for example, the same groups that were receiving money through Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty were set up into an organization, a very respectable, quote-unquote, organization, called the Assembly of Captive European Nations. Now, many of the... And what the Assembly was supposed to be was sort of a counter-United Nations. The East Bloc governments of Czechoslovakia and Poland and so forth had their representatives in the United Nations, and they would put forward their version of world events in the UN, and also the story that Poland, for example, was supposedly a great democratic country during these years, and so forth. Well, the idea of the Assembly of Captive European Nations was to have emigres from those countries set up sort of a counter-United Nations that would show that what the official Polish government was saying was not so. What happened, however, was that some of the delegations in this assembly, not all, but some, were dominated by groups that had collaborated with the Nazis during World War II. And I was looking just this morning, as a matter of fact, at the Albanian delegation, and records from the U.S. National Archives concerning Albanian war criminals. These date from 1945, and they're lists of people that the United States, Albanians, that the United States was investigating and attempting to capture as war criminals in 1945. Well, if you go back and you look at the leadership list of the Albanian delegation in ACEN, this assembly, what you see is half of the leadership in the assembly are on the war crimes list from 1945. And this pattern repeated itself a number of times. Well, the money that the CIA was giving to Radio Free Europe, which in turn was giving to the Assembly, was spent, or part of it, was spent on lobbying Congress. Now, this is explicitly against the law. The CIA does not have the authority and is specifically barred this money from spending its money on lobbying Congress. But nonetheless, there were these assembly people on the payroll of the agency lobbying Congress, and they would attempt to influence Congress on issues such as trade and recognition of East Bloc governments as far as trade is concerned, on military spending, on whether or not to have summits, you know, with the Soviets, and this type of thing. The range of foreign affairs that the Congress engages in as far as East-West relations are concerned.
I have another caller here, and again, we're moving like into our last 15 minutes, so I want to remind people who are listening, if you do want to call in, please don't wait till the very end. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. Well, let's go here to our toll-free line, talk with someone else. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I was wondering if your guest is familiar with an operation by the name of Operation Keelhaul, which I think took place in 1945 or 1946, when the U.S. and Great Britain, I believe it was, handed back to the Soviet Union a couple of thousand Russians who had enlisted in General Vlasov's army under Nazi Germany. Basically, it was an army that was going to be used on the East Front. It fought in a couple of engagements in 45. And then the decision, political decision, was made to hand them all back to the Soviet Union afterwards, where most of them went to their deaths. I was wondering if he was familiar with this operation,
yes,
because it seems to fly counter to his argument.
No, it doesn't fly counter to the argument. Yes, I am familiar with it. Basically, it was a product of wartime agreements between the different Allied forces concerning treatment of prisoners of war. Now, the Soviets had in their hands a number of Americans who had been prisoners of Axis countries, who had been captured by the Soviets when the Soviets moved across Europe. And similarly, the Americans had these Vlasov Army veterans in their hands that they had captured or who had surrendered to the Americans in the final months of the war. And the agreements between East and West at that stage were that you exchange these prisoners. And that's exactly what happened. Now, the Vlasov Army veterans were quite upset about this. And he's right that many of them were killed, and those that were not killed were given extremely long prison sentences in the Soviet Gulag. And some of those sentences ended up being death sentences in effect. However, there are a number of myths about this Vlasov army, which are very popular in the United States, which simply are not true. One of the myths is that these people were simply anti-Stalin freedom fighters. Not so. The fact of the matter is that the better part of the Vlasov army had in fact been white Russian Nazi collaborators that had been led by a man by the name of Kaminsky. These were SS veterans, and they had been directly and personally involved in the mass murder programs in Belarus, and also in the suppression of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. They were extremely violent people with quite a bit of blood on their hands. They weren't good guys. And when the United States returned these POWs, particularly in exchange for American POWs, this was a perfectly in tune with American policy at the time.
Does that get at your question? Oh, I guess it must have because he hung up. Other questions are welcome. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We're talking with Christopher Simpson, the author of Blowback, a story of the recruitment of Nazis and former Nazi collaborators by U.S. intelligence, by the CIA, and by military intelligence. And if you have questions, we certainly have enough time here to take some others.
I think let's look at this myth-making process just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect that perhaps the previous caller was a little bit annoyed. Maybe so. I think this is the creation of myths about groups such as the Vlasov Army was one of the main thrusts of the publicity activities during the late 1940s and early 1950s. And the Vlasov group in particular, who those people were this. Vlasov was a Red Army general who had defected to the Germans in 1942. And Vlasov himself wanted to set up an army under German sponsorship that would overthrow Stalin, which seems like a not an entirely unreasonable thing to do. But the fact of the matter is that the Nazis were running the show from the beginning. Vlasov was not the true leader of this organization. He was simply a puppet that the Germans were using. The people who joined the Vlasov army were not volunteers for the most part. They were people who were assigned by the SS to Vlasov's forces and who acted under the control of Nazi Germany. The history of these forces is clear. It's on the public record. This is not a matter of some Soviet accusation about what these people did. This can be found in American records in the National Archives. And basically what it was is that the SS would create these militia forces in the areas that were under Nazi occupation. The militia forces were used for the mass murder work. They used them for the dirty work that not even the Nazis wanted to do. They used them to locate Jews for murder, and they used them to shoot them down in ditches. Now, when Germany's military fortunes were reversed, some of these same militia forces were assigned to the Vlasov Army. After the war, the Vlasov Army veterans would say, oh, well, I was in the Vlasov Army. I didn't have anything to do with these massacres. But it simply isn't true. You have to look at what made up the Vlasov Army. Where did these people come from before they joined the Vlasov Army? And what you see is quite an unpleasant picture.
Mm-hmm. Well, let us take another caller here, again on our toll-free line. Hello.
Oh, hello. I was born in 1945, and as a boy growing up, what I heard from various sources was that the Russians got all the German rocket scientists, and the United States hadn't gotten any, and then that they only got one, Wernher von Braun. I never heard anything about the fact that the United States collected virtually the whole Nordhausen team intact. I never heard anything about how the Americans were using SS people, security people, propaganda people, and so on, and planting them in various places around the world, particularly in Latin America. All the collaborators, what few of them that there were in the 40s and the 50s, were French. Never heard anything about the Ukrainians and the Poles, who were many of them almost as rabid as the Germans. It was always the Germans. It was never the Hungarians or the Austrians and so on. So I'm wondering if you include in your book any of the information about this fabulous snow job that was perpetrated on the American people. I was shocked and horrified to find out about Arthur Rudolph and those people down there working at Cape Canaveral who had been blowing away Jews right and left during the war. This was 40 years on.
Right, right. Yeah, what this book does is document quite a bit of that, snow job. That's from U.S. Records.
And did you want to follow up on
that? I was listening, and I heard you discussing what Americans did with Germans that they had captured with high-level Nazis, how they utilized them and so on. But I, what I remember so well was how I was snowed, you see. Not I'd never, until today, I hadn't heard of the Vlasov Army and so on, and I can see that your scholarship is great, but I was more curious about what measures were taken by our government, by the Central Intelligence Agency, and I don't know who all, to deceive the American people.
Well, yes, there were quite a number of measures, and one of them was the publicity campaign that we were talking about a little while ago through the Crusade for Freedom. Also, there were articles in magazines that are discussed in the book that the intelligence services assisted in placing in American magazines, like Look Magazine, that type of thing, that painted a very false picture of who Nazi Germany's collaborators had been during the war and what they'd done during the war.
Well, let me ask you this question. Prompted by some of the discussion we've had so far, who in the United States did know, and at what levels of government was the recruiting of these people authorized and approved of?
That's an excellent question. And part of it is almost a philosophical question, if you will. It's because there was quite a bit of the phenomena of people knowing in general what was going on, but refusing to ask the specific questions that they would need to know the real story. I'll give you an example. When Galen was recruited, Galen that we were talking about mm-hmm. earlier in the program, mm-hmm. One of the men who was instrumental in that process was then the U.S. intelligence chief in Europe, General Edwin Seibert. Mr. Seibert was in no sense a dummy. I mean, he had become a chief of intelligence through very skilled work over many years. Galen came along and told him, we will refuse on principle to hire any SS men in this post-war organization. Well, the fact is that this was false, and we can see today that there was a whole raft of SS men who were hired in the first batch. Well, how does this happen? Was General Seibert just naive? No, I don't think so. I think General Seibert knew exactly what was going on. But he did not want to confront the circumstances. It's because he was better off getting the intelligence that he was looking for without confronting what was actually happening.
Mm-hmm. Did both Presidents Truman and Eisenhower know what had been done?
Well, they knew some aspects, but not all. And frankly, I don't think they knew the full implications of it. It's because I think if someone had gone to Eisenhower or Truman and said very bluntly, here's a list of Nazis on the U.S. payroll, I think that he would have been forced to halt the practice. But let me give you an example. First of all, it's in talking about the high-level knowledge of this, here's how it works. It works through euphemism and double talk. There was a series of decisions made by the U.S. National Security Council in 1948, and this is the most senior security body in the country. They work directly with the president. And the decision was that the U.S. strategy for dealing with the Soviets would be to try to bottle up the Soviet Union, bottle up the internal stresses in the Soviet Union until the country fell apart or until it dissolved into civil war. Now, in order to do that, there was a specific decision made not to pick and choose among the various emigre groups who were attempting to return to the Soviet Union and overthrow Stalin's government. Well, in 1948, that had a very specific meaning. It meant that we would indeed assist those groups that had been SS groups during the war who were attempting to go back to the Soviet Union and overthrow Stalin. It meant that we would not discriminate, quote-unquote, against people who had been Nazis or Nazi collaborators during the war. This was a very high-level decision. It doesn't say, let's go out and finance Nazis who are trying to overthrow Stalin. It does say, we will make no distinction among the different groups attempting to overthrow Stalin. Do you see how it's done?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's essentially the old saying of any enemy of my enemy is a friend of mine.
That's right. That's right. But that's right. And the question is whether or not that old saying really is true, and whether or not that old saying has actually produce the results that we as Americans want to have as far as our international policy is concerned.
Mm-hmm. Let's. I have one more person here, and then we're just about out of time. We'll go back to our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Yes.
You know, I had heard that many of the German scientists, they wanted to surrender to ROSS because they didn't want to go to Russia. You know,
Right. They
wanted to come to this country, and they felt that that they would have a better opportunity here to work, you know, and everything. And but that's what I had always heard. And as far as you're talking about the military people now, after every war, you'll find a certain percentage of the people that participate in the war, generals and sergeants, I don't care what they are, they will become mercenaries. And they'll work, and they'll, well, that's why you got this Soldier of Fortune magazine. They hire themselves out and contract themselves out and fight for money, you know?
Sure. And
you'll find a lot of this going on now. I don't know so much anymore, but I know in the mid-60s there were quite a few Germans fighting like down in Panama that were mercenaries, you know, and such, you know, in our behalf. But they were being paid. It wasn't that they favored us politically. It was just that we had the most bucks, you know. So, but this goes on, I think, in every after every war, like I was saying, that I don't know how many of them are left now. I imagine they're getting pretty old now.
Yeah.
You know? But another thing I had heard, I don't know, have you ever heard of Morton Downey Jr.?
Sure, of course.
Okay, well, a lot of people haven't, but anyhow, he has a talk show, and I heard him state one time that, now, I don't know whether he was at a cocktail party in the, he said it was in 66, and they, whoever was there had met Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun at a cocktail party. Have you ever heard that?
I haven't heard that particular story, no.
Uh-huh. But, yeah, you know,
1966?
Yeah, I think he said it was in 1960. It was in the 60s.
Well, I think that he's made...
Now, that would have made Hitler...
He might have met somebody that told that story.
Well, that may have been.
The story is false.
What's that?
The story is false. Adolf Hitler died in the bunker. The evidence of Hitler's death in the bunker is well established.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump in. We're just out of time, and I'm sure we could continue to talk for a long time. I will just say that I think that the book is a fascinating one, and if people are interested, they might take a look at it. Again, the title of the book is Blowback. It's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. The author is Christopher Simpson. Thank you very much for spending the time with us today.
Sure, my pleasure.